You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. The 13th Amendment ended slavery in the United States, or did it? In this podcast, Pulitzer Prize winner Douglas A. Blackman talks about what really happened during Reconstruction. Douglas Blackman is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. He is chair of the University of Virginia's Miller Center Forum Program and a contributing editor at The Washington Post. Mr. Blackman's book was awarded the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. The book also received many additional awards and citations and was a New York Times bestseller. Mr. Blackman is also co-executive producer of a documentary film based on the book, which was broadcast on PBS last year. Mr. Blackman spoke at the Wednesday, February 13, 2013 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Vice President Bob McGrath.
It's my privilege to introduce to you today's speaker. Douglas A. Blackman is the author of Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. He's also the chair of the University of Virginia's Miller Center Forum. The forum events that many of us are familiar with are now broadcast by the order of 100 PBS channels around the country. He's also a contributing editor at the Washington Post. His book, An Examination of How the Enslavement of African Americans Persisted Deep into the 20th Century, profoundly sculpted current American life, and it was awarded the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. In addition to the Pulitzer Prize, the book was a New York Times bestseller in both hardback and softcover editions, and was awarded a 2009 American Book Award and the NAACP Freedom Fund Outstanding Achievement Award, to name just two of the many awards and citations the book garnered. Janet Maslin wrote in the New York Times that the book is, quote, relentless and fascinating, and, quote, will now haunt us all. New York University Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Levering Lewis says the book reveals, quote, an American Holocaust that dare not speak its name, a riveting and terrifying history of six decades of racial degradation in the service of white supremacy. Bill Moyers called Slavery by Another Name brilliant reporting. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote that the book illuminates an ignominious economic system that depended on coerced labor and didn't flinch from savagery toward fellow human beings. Blackman's exhaustive reporting should put an end to the oft-repeated slander that black Americans tend toward lawlessness. Mr. Blackman was co-executive producer of a documentary film based on the book, which many of us had a chance to see last year on PBS. He's a much sought-after lecturer on race, history, and social memory. At the invitation of Attorney General Eric Holder, he lectured to senior officials at the Department of Justice. He's given lectures at many, many other places, including Harvard's Law School, Yale, the New School, Emory University, Vanderbilt's Law School, and the Clinton and Lincoln Presidential Libraries. Until 2011, Mr. Blackman was the longtime chief of the Wall Street Journal's Atlanta Bureau and the paper's senior national correspondent. He's written about or directed coverage of some of the most pivotal stories in American life, including the election of President Obama, the rise of the Tea Party movement, and the BP oil spill. He and his team of reporters at the Wall Street Journal were responsible for the acclaimed coverage of Hurricane Katrina and the failed federal response after that disaster. His international assignments have included many of the most important stories of the last 20 or 25 years. And here at home, he has covered in depth not only the last presidential election, but the three presidential elections before that. He joined the Journal in 1995. Prior to that, he was a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's written extensively throughout his career about the American quandary of race, exploring the integration of schools during his childhood in a Mississippi Delta farm town, lost episodes of the civil rights movement, and repeatedly the dilemma of how a contemporary society should grapple with its troubled past. Many of his stories as a journalist have explored these subjects. He was raised in Leland, Mississippi. He wrote his first newspaper story for the weekly Leland Progress at the age of 12. Obviously very precocious. He presently timeshares between Charlottesville and Atlanta, where his family makes their home. Now, Doug is not solely an observer of society and a journalist, an acclaimed journalist. He's an activist. He co-founded and served on the boards of two socially and ethnically diverse charter schools in Atlanta's inner city. The schools have more than 400 students, including his own two children. So we're very pleased to have Mr. Blackman here with us today. Doug, please talk to us.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. It's great to be here. Great to see some of you who I already know from coming to Miller Center Forums. I hope I'll see more of you there, and some of you who I don't know until today, I hope that you'll come check out the forums as well. You probably know them, knew my predecessor, the legendary George Gillum, who made the forums what they were, and I promise that the changes that I have been making are not as radical as you may have heard. I'll leave it at that. But it is good to be here, and interesting to endeavor on the topic that that you may have seen the title for this conversation, and that is the idea of reckoning with our tortured racial history as Americans in the age of President Obama, and this idea of here we are, not just as demonstrated by the having the first African-American president, but that to elect an African-American president and then re-elect an African-American, that no matter what your politics may be, that's a remarkable thing, obviously, and a signal of dramatic change in American life. But we also have an African-American chief law enforcement officer in the Attorney General, Eric Holder. We've had African-Americans as secretaries of state, African-Americans in the highest positions of the military, on the Supreme Court. Again, no matter what you think of any of these people as individuals or their politics, these are stunning things that have occurred in just a very short period of time in American life and signal tremendous change and progress in one way or another. And so what I'll talk about a bit is this notion of, having said all that, having acknowledged all of that, what do we do then, if anything, about the about this history that we have as well, some of which we now clearly understand and generally all agree about, mistakes that were made in the past, but also a lot of things that that we still really don't understand on a broad basis. And that's where what my book relates to. I'll talk for a second, though, before I go into that, about the Miller Center, and I do know that all of you are, or almost all of you, I'm sure, are pretty familiar with it. But you know what the Miller Center is about, in many respects, is this tremendous group of scholars who work there and work on presidential history and the history of the executive branch, but also more generally on the notion that there are lessons from history, and that the reason to study the past and to study it in a methodical way is partly so that we can draw wisdoms from the decisions and the mistakes that happened in the past and apply those wisdoms to the dilemmas that face us in the present. And to a group like this, it's more obvious than it is to the students at UVA that there are important lessons that come from life experience and the experiences of history. You guys understand that better than they do. But that is the ethos of the Miller Center, that these lessons of the past for the present and the different ways that we might explore that. And I think that also applies very precisely to what I'll talk about in terms of my book. And what motivates me as a writer, particularly in this particular area of the things that I've paid a lot of attention to, what do we do with the past? What do we when what I call the persistent past? Because the thing about the past is that, as inclined as we often are to forget a lot of things, there are elements of the past and things that happened in our own lives and in the life of our nation and in the life of humanity. There are some aspects of history that just won't allow themselves to be forgotten, to be completely forgotten. They just keep coming back, keep insisting on being remembered. And sometimes they almost disappear, and then they come back, and they insist on being remembered again. But it is a real question. What do we do about that? Do we just get mad about things that happened in the past, or get mad at the folks who were there then? Do we take the view that, particularly when it comes to the issue of race in America, some folks would also argue today that it's time to begin forgetting, or at least to begin not paying quite so much attention to some of these things that occurred in the past, that there's been so much progress as measured by the things I was just describing and many other measures, that maybe it's time to not talk so much about what happened in the past and let a new generation of Americans come in, grow up in maturity and not necessarily have to carry the burdens of some of the things that went on in the past. And that's a reasonable discussion to have, of should it be that way, or should we pay a lot of attention to these things that occurred. But so that's some of what I'll talk about, and I hope that you'll talk about with me. I won't talk for too long, and then I hope we can have a spirited dialogue. We can also talk about some of the other things that that I've been lucky enough to get to be a witness to, or to write and report about over the course of a fortunate career and the years that I spent at the Wall Street Journal. But I did get to see a lot of pretty remarkable things as a journalist, including the fall of the Berlin Wall in November 1989 and some of the other things that were mentioned. And I've been in war zones and political zones and a whole variety of things, all of which made me ready for the more restful life that comes now here in Charlottesville. First, let me tell you a little bit about the book, because I realize that there are one or two of you in the room who have not yet finished reading it. The dilemma of every author since Moses. Slavery by Another Name is the story of how, at the end of the Civil War, after the passage of the 13th Amendment and then the 14th, the 15th Amendments that extended full citizenship to the formerly enslaved African Americans, that after those events occurred, and that if any of you have seen Lincoln, the film that so dramatically portrays a part of that sequence of events, but after that euphoric moment for part of the country, that euphoric moment when the 13th Amendment has made it through Congress and clearly is going to be adopted, and slavery is abolished, and slavery is unconstitutional from that moment forward, that something that most of us don't know about happened that is counter to the conventional history. And what that is that while we do know about, and I suspect all of you, the students that I encounter now have studied almost no history whatsoever and know almost nothing about the American story, don't even know the American myths oftentimes. All of you I can count on had a reasonable measure of American history along the way. But so you do know the story of Reconstruction, the period of time right after the Civil War, this tumultuous period when the country is trying to figure out how to put itself back together again, and there are competing ideas about how that should happen, and the death of President Lincoln complicates things tremendously. And in the midst of all that, there's also this huge question of what's really going to happen to the formerly enslaved African Americans. And these laws have been passed that extend full citizenship to them, including voting, even though there were really hardly, there were very, very few white Americans at the end of the Civil War who really believed that it was a good idea to extend the vote to African Americans. That was the most controversial aspect of what was happening in terms of the 13th Amendment and then the subsequent ones. But nonetheless, that happens. But there's still a big question of how's this really going to work? How's this really going to play out? In part because Americans at that stage of the game, you know, were still confused. There was a lot of conflict and confusion about who should vote and who should be a full citizen. You know, women were not really full citizens and could not vote, obviously, at that time. And in many, many places, nobody could vote unless they were property holders and such. And so there was certainly a huge racial component to it, but there was also just a complex idea of who really ought to be qualified to be a full citizen or really a decision maker in our society. And there certainly was not a widely held view that African Americans should be in that group, male, female. And so in the midst of that Reconstruction period, when all this conflict is going on, all this debate, nonetheless, African Americans in those first years after the Civil War seize upon these new rights of citizenship. And contrary to the version of Reconstruction that you would have learned, you would have heard from almost all American history textbooks, even as recently as the 1970s, there still was a very strong strain of the story about Reconstruction was that this was this terrible time for Southerners and that for white Southerners, and that during that period that that there was chaos across the land, and that African Americans voting caused huge turmoil, and that the state legislatures and governorships of the South were taken over by African Americans, and that this led to corruption and lawlessness because of the African Americans being unready for freedom, in essence. And that version of events was the standard American account from the late 19th century up until the 1970s. And it's fundamentally false. And I think most people who are at all interested in history know that at this point. But that version of what happened right after the Civil War has been completely and totally discredited. It's a white supremacist mythology of what happened. And the truth of those years is radically different. And instead, it was a chaotic time. And it was a time in which there was a tremendous amount of violence and civil turmoil. Though if you go back, as I have, and look at the in close detail at the criminal arrest records and the granular details of what was happening in county after county after county all across the South in that period of time, what you find is that there was a lot of lawlessness and violence, though it was really motivated not so much by the behaviors of the freed, formerly enslaved, but that white people had set upon each other with incredible vengeance. There were all these folks coming back from, all these men coming back from the war with all sorts of scores to settle. And the guy back home who had been in charge of conscription, who had late in the war had gone around and forced your young brother to go to battle and gets killed at Gettysburg, and you make it back and he doesn't make it back. Well, that guy who was going around rounding up the young boys and sending them off to war at the end, that's somebody you've got a score to settle with. There were lots of white Southerners who actually never supported the war. There were people who had been holed up out in the woods, and some of them had become bandits. Some of them were insurgents, freedom fighters, you might even call them. All sorts of people are setting upon each other in the chaos of those first years. But it's overwhelmingly white on white violence, and then to some degree white on black violence. But the lawlessness is motivated not by and stemming not from the inadequacies as the legend became of African Americans, but on all of these issues among the white folks after the war. But meanwhile, while all that's happening, African Americans, even though they are incredibly impoverished and have been denied education, obviously by law for generations and generations, there's a tremendous movement by African Americans to assert their independence and grab on to real citizenship. And so they participate in elections on a huge scale. Millions of African Americans become involved in politics, hundreds of thousands, I should say, actually, participate in elections all across the South. There are black elected officials, though not nearly as many as people think that there were. But there were many black elected officials. African Americans, by and large, work extremely hard to get away from the white people who had controlled their lives previously. The mythologies about the the slaves who so loved their masters that they stayed behind and just wanted to keep helping them out. Those are largely fairy tales. Versions of that occurred in some respects, but the reality was that the former slaves wanted to get away from the folks who had controlled them before and set up independent lives, and they did that on a huge scale. Difficult lives, impoverished lives, but real independence and real political participation. They acquired property, and by one means or another, they swarmed into schools that were set up. The first real public schools in America were being established in that period of time, schools that were open to everybody, and African Americans swarmed into those schools, and the literacy rate among African Americans skyrocketed. It went from essentially zero at the end of the Civil War to numbers that were like 30, 40, 50% in large parts of the South. And that was roughly equivalent to what the literacy rate was among white Southerners at the time, certainly among poor whites. And so you had this tremendous, tremendous movement toward moving into the mainstream of American life and leveraging the opportunities that the American system allowed for everybody else. But then a terrible thing begins. Number one, and this is what my book is really about. Number one, the whites in the South simply couldn't resurrect, didn't know how to, couldn't intellectually get their mind around how to resurrect the cotton economy. And of course, the cotton economy was the single biggest industry in America in the 1860s and was the most important, single most important economic element of American life in the 1860s. And it's simply the white folks who controlled the land and needed to resurrect that economy simply couldn't do it without 4 million enslaved workers and simply could not bring themselves to conceive of a way to enter into fair, equitable labor arrangements with these 4 million people that soon became 5 and 6 and 8 and 9 million people. White folks in the South just couldn't do it. Couldn't do it, wouldn't do it. And so there was this tremendous need economically to figure out how to get as many African Americans as possible back into a condition as close to slavery as possible. And so that begins this economic imperative to recreate something that closely resembled the old slavery. The other thing that's happening at the same time is that whites in the South really, really want to stop African Americans from exercising their civil rights and get them out of the political process. And so over time, those two objectives, one economic, one political, motivate what becomes a terrible shadow that falls across black life, falls across American life. And so beginning in the 1870s, then the 1880s, all the southern states begin passing laws that are designed to essentially criminalize black life. It's a little bit like what happened in Germany in the mid-1930s. And you have to be careful not to compare giant social crimes, because they're not the same, and this isn't a ranking of them in any way, but there are elements that are similar. Where in Germany in the 1930s, as the Nazis have seized power and seek to contain and control and do things to the Jewish population of Central Europe, they begin to pass laws that effectively make it a crime to engage in the behaviors that were typical in Jewish life at the time. And once you pass laws that effectively make a particular category of people criminals at all times, regardless of whether they're actually doing anything damaging to society. Once you criminalize a group of people, well, there is no law at all. That's the disappearance of law. And the expression of pure power and pure force by another group. And that's essentially what begins to happen to African Americans in that period of time. So it becomes a crime for things that don't make any sense to us anymore, even just the basic logic of them don't make sense. It becomes a crime for any farmer to sell his produce from his farm after dark. Doesn't make any sense, does it? Well, the reason for that is so that the initial reason for that is so that if a man is working a piece of land owned by somebody else, which is typically what was the case for an African-American farm worker, if he grew enough produce or some stuff beyond what the main crop was that he was going to share with the landowner, if you made it a crime for him to sell produce after dark, well, that meant that he couldn't go anywhere else. He couldn't leave the farm and go into town and spend the night there or go down the road to find a buyer, a real market for his products. He's got to sell whatever he grows to the man who owns the land or the man who controls his part of the county. It's a crime to walk beside a railroad. Why is that? Well, because in this era when there were no decent roads, the way that poor people got from one town to the next was by walking along the railroad. And that's how African Americans got from one town to the next or one settlement to the next. It's a crime to speak loudly in the company of a white woman. It's a crime, obviously, to be involved in romance or any sort of physical activity between a black man and a white woman. But the most insidious laws that were passed were ones that said that, number one, that imposed huge penalties, incredibly terrible penalties for vagrancy, the crime of not being employed at any time. And so if you couldn't prove at any given moment that you had a job, you could be arrested. And this happened to thousands and thousands of people in this period of time. But in addition to that, that it's a crime to not have a job, it was also a crime for a farm worker who was working for one man, working for one landowner, if he decided that there'd be a better situation for him working for a different landowner, or maybe he was being terribly abused, as was routinely common in that period of time, if the man that he worked for was whipping him in the field with the lash, and of course the lash was a ubiquitous element of the southern landscape deep into the 20th century. You know, if we traveled down through Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi in 1915 or 1920, you would have seen men in the fields with lashes whipping people all over the place. Routine way of managing laborers in that period of time. But so you're working on a farm where you're being whipped in the field, you're being deprived of your share of the proceeds of the crop at the end of the season routinely, which happened all the time, but you're being treated in terrible ways, perhaps being starved, all but starved. Perhaps your wife is being abused in terrible ways by the landowner, which is also incredibly common in that period. So you've got this terrible situation. If you then decide to go down the road and try to work for a different man, or even if that man comes along and says, hey, why don't you come work for me? I'll give you a better deal. If a farm worker pursued that opportunity without permission from the first guy, then he was committing a crime. He was breaking the law. It's called the contract labor law or false pretense statute at the time. And so it was a crime to not have a job, and it was a crime to look for a job. Is this terrible catch-22 for now? None of those laws said anywhere in them that this only applies to African Americans. You know, because in this era after the Civil War, laws there no longer can be laws that are written specific to a particular race. But overwhelmingly, and I've gone through the records of tens of thousands of arrests, maybe hundreds of thousands. I've lost count of how many individual cases I've looked at. But overwhelmingly, and by that I mean 80%, 90%, 95%, these laws were only ever applied to African Americans. So their very specific purpose was to create this legal jeopardy into which African Americans could be drawn at almost any given moment. And then as these laws began to be applied to African Americans in such huge numbers, the way that people were punished was through the old fee system. Does anybody remember? Some of you may have known about the fee system. It actually lasted pretty deep into the 20th century. But the fee system was that back in those days, the county sheriff and most local officials didn't get any kind of salary for the position that they held, for these elected positions. And so instead, the sheriff in most southern states was paid by fees that were charged to the people he arrested. And so if you got arrested, you had to pay a fee to the sheriff who arrested you, and then there was another fee that you paid to the deputy sheriff who was involved in it. You had to pay a fee to each of the witnesses who testified against you if you had a trial. You had to pay a fee to the clerk at the courthouse who handled the paperwork when you ended up down there. You might have to pay a fee to the jailer who received you when you were taken down to the county jail. And so someone arrested for vagrancy might be fined by a judge something like $5. That would be a typical fine for vagrancy, which sounds like an inconsequential sum today, but then was not inconsequential, but still was not a gigantic thing. That was not a life-ending penalty to have to pay a $5 fine. But the fees that would go with that $5 fine would often add up to $80 or $90 or $100. And so you'd end up with that for this incredibly trivial offense, which you might or might not have actually committed, you know, because as the system developed, there began to be, as the need for more arrests grew, there were all sorts of people who were just rounded up and blanket charged with vagrancy or one of these other statutes, and there's no reason or evidence to believe that they had actually done anything to cause that arrest. But so you end up with these fines imposed on you of $100 or $150. Well, in those days, a farm worker, a typical farm worker in the Deep South, if they made $75 a year or $100 a year, that was a pretty good year in 1910. And so that's the equivalent of essentially, in today's terms, if you try to imagine that if you got a speeding ticket and the penalty for your speeding ticket for being 9 miles an hour over the limit, if the penalty for that was $25,000 or $30,000, I mean, that's the equivalent of what was happening then. And so these itinerant farm workers at the beginning of the 20th century obviously were in no position whatsoever to be able to pay these fines. And of course, there was never really any expectation that they would pay these fines. That was not even the intention, because the system that was emerging was to impose upon these individuals these huge fines and fees, and that none of whom would ever be able to pay. And then, because they couldn't pay them, to lease them or sell them, which is actually the parlance of the day. You know, the paperwork talked about selling convicts and selling African Americans. And so to make this money back for the county, they would be sold in large groups, typically, to local coal mines, lumber camps, railroad crews, road building gangs that were popping up, large plantations, depending on where you were in the South, turpentine camps down in South Alabama, North Florida, South Mississippi, and Louisiana. So all of the new industries that are beginning to emerge in the late 19th century and the early 20th century of the South begin to rely in tremendous numbers on these forced laborers who are coming out of the court system. And so this begins to generate massive, massive amounts of money. It's the single largest source of funding for the state of Alabama for like 30 years. The single largest source of money. I will say Virginia, through a large part, every southern state was involved in this, and pretty much every county on a local level in the South, in one way or another, at one time or another, was involved in this. Virginia, actually, as a state government, had less of this for reasons I can't, haven't really been able to quite figure out. But nonetheless, you know, that's no, there's no real, that's no salve for the larger story. But this begins to generate huge amounts of money. The availability of these workers is incredibly valuable to these industries. It's a huge element of the reconstruction of the South in that period of time, and the reconstruction of the national economy. It takes a solid 35 years after the end of the Civil War for cotton production in the South to get back to the level that it had been in 1860. You know, it's not until the early 1900s that there's as much cotton being produced as there had been in 1860. And that coincides precisely with when this system reaches its full metastasization across the southern landscape, and at the same time, when almost all black voting in the South comes to an end, when Jim Crow segregation laws are finally fully in force in those first years of the 20th century. And so all of that comes together and is effectively the recreation of this new system of enslavement of African Americans that is different in some respects from the enslavement that had occurred before the Civil War, but nonetheless was slavery. And that system, in a huge form, in a huge scale, persists right up to the beginning of World War II, right up to the 1940s. And in the end, there were hundreds of thousands of African-American men and a much smaller number of African-American women, in relative terms, a very small number of African-American women, were arrested and forced into labor through this mechanism. But a much larger number, millions of African-Americans, watched this happening through all of these years, saw members of their own families sucked into this system or people in their communities. And so the fear of having this happen to you became one of the primary levers of intimidation and terrorism against African Americans during that whole period of time. And so to avoid that fate, African-American families would go along with all sorts of other things, like staying on a sharecrop farm where they're being cheated out of the proceeds of the crop every year, for year after year after year after year, generation after generation. Because if you tried to flee that man you had the sharecrop arrangement with, you were going to be arrested and you were going to be turned into a convict laborer. And there were hundreds of cases, probably thousands of cases, in which an African-American man would try to get away from one of these abusive landowners, would be arrested for having done so, and then would be returned to the same landowner, now working for nothing as an involuntary worker. The very same guy that just a few days before he had supposedly been in a business partnership with. And so the terror of having that happen became ubiquitous across the South. And then on top of that, the thing we're more familiar with, and that's the violence, the threat of violence against African Americans, that if they stepped outside the social customs and social norms, that they would be subject to lynchings or other kinds of mob violence. But the violence aspect of what happened in those days, in my opinion, has actually been somewhat overstated, not in terms of how much of it occurred. There was a tremendous amount of it, but in terms of what was really on the minds of African Americans across the board, out in the rural areas of the Deep South, the threat of violence was not as large as the threat of this other terrible thing that really could happen to anybody at any time. The violence incidents came less frequently, though with nonetheless terrible and terrifying frequency. But violence and this system of enslavement became the primary threats that hung over the heads of every African American family, and that were then used to intimidate African Americans away from trying to vote, trying to register to vote, using the courts to defend their interests in the ways that every other person could. And so the destruction of the civil rights of African Americans and the rigid enforcement of segregation all fits together, but has as this cornerstone the new form of involuntary servitude. So that's the essence of the book that I wrote. It grew out of a story that I first wrote in the Wall Street Journal almost 12 years ago. That story was just about a particular place in Alabama and a particular coal mine owned by U.S. Steel Corporation in the first years of the 20th century, where it was clear, even as I first began to look at it, that this was a place where there had been forced workers. And I wrote that story at the same time that, if you'll recall, in the late 90s and the first years of after 2000, there were these slave labor cases being brought in Germany by Holocaust survivors against the descendant corporations of the companies that had enslaved those Jews as young people during World War II. And so you had these elderly survivors of the Holocaust bring lawsuits against a company that connected, sometimes very circuitously, but filing lawsuits against these companies that had enslaved them 50 years earlier. And I was interested in that because those lawsuits were hopelessly doomed. There was no possibility that those lawsuits would prevail, even though they had tremendous moral authority. Obviously, the claims brought by those survivors were freighted with moral force. But legally, they had no hope, no chance whatsoever, because the documents that had been signed at the end of World War II, the surrender treaties and such, allowed for all sorts of reparations that were paid, reparations to Israel and various parties, money changed hands back in the 1940s and the 50s. But then the treaties foreclosed all further claims. No one could bring any additional claims stemming from the events of World War II or Nazi Germany. And so all of these cases were locked out from day one. But in the end, there was such moral suasion attached to them that the Clinton administration at the time became very supportive of these lawsuits. Laws were passed in the U.S. to make it possible to bring some of these suits in the U.S. courts. But more than anything, a tremendous social consensus developed in Germany, and also a somewhat self-serving business interest. The corporations of Germany concluded that the best thing was to reach some sort of big settlement and make all these cases go away. And so every German corporation over a certain size finally agreed to participate in a $5 billion settlement with these survivors of the Holocaust. And a similar thing happened with Swiss banks that had stolen the bank accounts victims of the Holocaust. And so those cases were percolating out there when I began to be interested in this place in Alabama where U.S. Steel Corporation had operated these coal mines with forced laborers. And I said to myself at the time, what would happen if we took this unforgiving lens through which German companies were being examined so closely and being given no slack whatsoever? What if we took that same lens and looked at American corporations? What would we see? What would we see? I ended up writing a number of stories that did that in different ways. And one of them was this first story out of Alabama and U.S. Steel Corporation, the most iconic American corporation based in Pennsylvania. Not some southern bad guy company, but this great northern corporation, the original modern corporation. It really was. U.S. Steel is the first modern corporation created in 1901. And then it had acquired this big coal mining company in the South in 1907 in what at that time was the largest financial transaction that had ever occurred in history, personally approved by Teddy Roosevelt. And when they did that acquisition, they acquired these slave mines in Alabama and continued to operate them, knowing that they were slave mines. And so the first story in the Wall Street Journal was about that specific place, and there was a big reaction to that story, much larger than I really anticipated, and that led me to be persuaded to write a book about it. And then that was supposed to take 2 years, and instead it took closer to eight, and became a big part of my life from that point on. And then the film, after the book came out, then we started working on the film, which was broadcast premiered a year ago, and will rebroadcast on PBS nationally on February 22nd. So if you missed it then, you can see it again. That's the story of that history, but there's a question that I should probably go ahead and tackle that someone here is already formulating that usually goes along the lines of, why would a white guy from the Mississippi Delta, who spent most of his career working at the most conservative newspaper in America, and at the end working for Rupert Murdoch specifically, why would that guy write a book like this or be this interested in this conversation? And there's a long, or why not? That's a good response. Why not was the response. And there's a longer version of that answer, but I don't want to take too much time with it. But it does go back to the place where I was born and where I grew up. I was born in the Mississippi Delta on the Arkansas side of the Mississippi River, and then I grew up on the Mississippi side of the river. But I was born in 1964, not long after the civil rights workers Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney were murdered in a place not all that far from where I would grow up. That was in 64. And in 65, there was a farm labor strike on a plantation just outside of the town where I grew up. That was the first farm labor action of any kind in the South since the Depression. And it was a small group of African-American tractor drivers and their families. The men drove tractors, and this was early in the mechanization of cotton farming. But the tractors were just then beginning to be to replace the mules and plows that had still been in force into the 1950s. So these small group of tractor drivers and their wives who would chop cotton in the spring and help with the harvest in the fall, and their children who would also chop cotton. But the small group went on strike on this one plantation in 1965. It was supposed to have been a huge strike on all the plantations of that part of the Delta, but on the night before the strike, all of the other plantation owners went out, and contrary to an agreement they'd made with each other, all the other plantation owners went to their workers and agreed to give everybody a dollar a day raise, because most of the tractor drivers were making $6 a day, and so they all got raises to $7 a day, and then there were slight raises for the other folks for chopping cotton. So the strike was called off on all the other plantations, but in an era without cell phones, and most of these folks didn't have phones of any kind in 1965, this one group didn't know that the strike was off. And so they go on strike, and it becomes very briefly a national event, a national news event. And that group then, they're thrown out of their homes, thrown off the place, They set up a tent encampment on some property owned by a black man who had a little country store. Then later, there's a piece of property bought for them by the heir to the Montgomery Ward fortune at the time, but a young white woman who secretly financed much of the civil rights movement. But so she bought a little piece of land, and the strikers moved to there and eventually built houses and created a community that came to be known as Strike City. And Strike City is still out there. There's still at least two living strikers still out there. But those men never worked again. They were blackballed. They couldn't work for the next 20 years, really. But then even after they probably could have gotten jobs again, they really didn't realize that, frankly. And so for the rest of their lives, for the most part, they never worked again. But so that was this big event that sort of hung over the community that I grew up in. Then in 1968, there was a march of African-American high school students from the black high school to the white high school, because even though the Brown decision had been 14 years earlier, just like here in Virginia, you still had de facto complete segregation, a little bit of the fake integration of a few black kids sprinkled into some white high schools. But essentially, you still had complete segregation in 1968. And so this group of black high school students marches across town to the white campus, singing songs, being very peaceful, and the redneck police chief of the town tear gasses them, and a melee ensues, windows are broken, fights break out, and in the midst of all that, this one 16-year-old African-American boy runs through the front door of a feed and seed store, and the man behind the counter pulls a pistol out and shoots him in the doorway. The boy survived, but there was never investigation, the man was never charged with anything. And so that's 1968. Then in 1969, the U.S. Supreme Court comes down with an order that's specific to my town and 29 other districts in Mississippi that says, enough of the delay. It's time to desegregate your schools 100% right now. Close your schools at Christmas, close your segregated systems, and reopen them January 1970, completely integrated. And so that's what happened, and that's why integration happened almost everywhere in 1970 and 71, real, authentic integration, including in Virginia. And so I then started the first grade in the fall of 1970. So I was in the first class of children in Mississippi to begin the first day of first grade, black and white together, and go through 12 grades of public education, black and white. Now, most of the white kids were gone, on day one. And of those who were there on day one, most of them were gone within a couple of years. And so the schools that I grew up in were, in the beginning, about 70% African American, and by the end, about 80% or a little more percent African American. But that was successful integration by Mississippi standards and by most of the South. Because this also I left out. This was a majority black town in a majority black county. That part of Mississippi is, particularly in those days, overwhelmingly African American in population because of the need for the farm workers, those 4 million enslaved people who were so critical back in 1865. And these are their descendants who are still so critical. So that's when I start the first grade. Now, at that time, I, of course, didn't know any of the things that I just told you about that period of time because I was a six-year-old boy. I later learned all of those events. But I did know at the time that something was up. Something was going on that no one would explain. And so I was acutely aware of that. For some reason, all of the black kids appeared to be mad at me at all times, as far as I was concerned. And so all of us white kids were mad back at them, even though we couldn't really identify exactly why we were all mad. And then there was all the other white kids, the majority of the white kids, who were not in the public schools already, but who were the kids that I went to church with. And, of course, all the rest of life was still totally segregated. The baseball team in the summer, the swimming pool, even though it was owned by the city, Boy Scouts, everything else in life was completely segregated. And so most of the white kids I knew in my segregated life were also mad at all of us white kids who were at the public schools, and so we were mad at them too. And so there was all this people mad at people, and nobody really quite knowing why exactly, and no one really ready to engage in a conversation about it. And so for whatever reason, I just had an acute sensitivity to to all of that and began to ask a lot of questions about, well, you know, why is it this way? Why is it that all the black people I know live, with very few exceptions, lived in desperate poverty, and all the white people I knew lived in at least reasonable, not poverty of some kind? And I didn't come from a big landowning family or anything like that. We were a pretty typical lower middle class professional family. My father worked for the government. But so I just began to ask a lot of questions about all of that. And sometimes I got answers and sometimes I did not. But as the years went by, I just kept asking questions. And many years later, after I was working as a writer, I decided to, I had come to realize by then that by chance I was in this sort of landmark group of students who had begun the first grade together. And I decided to go back to Mississippi and sort of figure out what had really happened and what it had all added up to. And that's actually the subject of my next book and the next film that I hope to make. But now 20 years ago, I went back and I wrote a long essay about, after I had reconstructed those events, and I found that and I learned all those things, and I learned a lot of other things, such as, for instance, the story of Strike City, which I had first heard about Strike City when I was in middle school. I still don't know why, because Strike City and that incident, that was something that no white person would have ever spoken of, certainly not to a child. That had been such a powerful convulsive moment in the life of that community that no white person would have ever spoken of it again. It was all but erased from the collective memory of white people as far as I could tell. But somehow I had heard something about it when I was in middle school, and I had actually written an essay about it when I was in the seventh grade. The reason I wrote that essay was because when I went back these years later to reconstruct these events, I rediscovered this essay that I had written in the seventh grade. But the reason that I wrote it was that the County Historical Society, which of course was a collection of little old white ladies who were interested in the county history, it had organized an essay contest to mark the sesquicentennial of the county, 150th anniversary of the county. And any student at any school in the county could write an essay on any topic related to the history of the county, wide open parameters. And so I somehow had become aware of Strike City. And so I wrote this little essay about Strike City, a little seventh grader's essay, with this very heroic story of these brave strikers and how they survived the attacks by the Ku Klux Klan, which they had been shot up by the Klan at one point, and had persevered, and then Martin Luther King had come along and everything had been fixed. Everything had turned out grand, was my essay. And I sent the thing in, and a few weeks later, a letter comes in the mail, a very unusual thing for a 12-year-old back in the 70s. And I open the letter up, and I take it out, and it's from the president of the Historical Society that says that I had won second place in the contest, and that I should go to the county fair on a particular date, particular place, and that Mrs. Baker, the letter writer, would be at that place in a blue dress, and that I should meet her there. And so my mother dropped me off at the county fair, something that no one would do, at least with a 12-year-old today. Certainly I wouldn't. And I went to the appointed place. There was a white lady in a blue dress, obviously Mrs. Baker. But I was too timid. I was afraid that I might be wrong, and that if I went up and spoke to her, that it wouldn't be her, and I would be embarrassed. And so I stood there for a long time waiting for her to identify me in the mysterious ways that a child's mind works. And so I stood there for a long time. She looked at me several times, no glimmer of recognition. Then finally, another little white boy comes walking up, and they immediately identify each other. And I can tell, and I knew this kid from, he went to one of the all-white schools that had been set up to preserve segregation, but I knew him from church. And so he walks up, and they start talking, and they reference the contest. And so I realize he's also a winner, and so this is that's Mrs. Baker. So I go up and introduce myself and say that I'm Doug Blackman. And I don't know if it was in that exact instant or if it came to me later, but I realized from the expression of her face that based on the topic of my essay, the fact that I went to an overwhelmingly black school, the coincidental oddity of my last name, that I was supposed to have been the little African-American boy getting the essay contest that day. So I've always joked that that makes me a very early beneficiary of affirmative action. But then the next year, for the town oratorical contest, I converted my essay into a speech. And I won the junior high school competition, and the finals were before the Lions Club, the sponsor of the contest, at one of their weekly meetings, and the two winners from the high school and the one from the junior high school would give our speeches to the Lions Club. And so we got to the day of that. The other two winners were high school girls who gave the kinds of speeches that you're supposed to give in high school about the next generation new leaders of America. And they give their speeches, and then I get up there and give my speech about Strike City and this farm labor strike. And as soon as I start, I realize that, again, something is up because the men who were there, and of course it's all men at that time, they snicker in, you know, places that are not funny. And then they don't really react to the swelling parts about the strikers surviving the attacks of the Ku Klux Klan. And of course, it had not occurred to me that that I might be giving my speech to the Ku Klux Klansmen who had attacked the strikers. But in fact, I was. And so I did not win the speech contest. And then after the speech was over, we were shaking hands as the men filed out, and this one guy hung back for a long time, and then after all the others had gone by, he came up to me, and the way I remember him is that he was about 8 feet tall and had crazy white hair and was 100 years old. I suspect that he looked a lot like I look right now in reality, but he came up and he just lit into me, and you know, said, "Where'd you get all that, boy? You know, who told you all that? You know, that's all lies. Did your mom and daddy tell you those stories? Nothing like that happened." And so he went on. He began to fulminate more and more, sort of pushing up into my face. Finally, got so sort of hysterical that my English teacher sort of forced herself between the two of us, and told him to calm down. And he spun around on his heels and took off out the door. And then, and to me, it was just more mysterious adult behavior. What on earth was that about? And so then a few days later, another letter arrives in the mail. Again, strange thing. This time it's from the president of the Lions Club, and it's a very formal apology for the incident that had occurred after the Lions Club meeting the previous week. Again, mysterious adult behavior. It made no sense to me whatsoever. But I did notice that after that, there never was another Lions Club oratorical contest. That was the end of that tradition in Leland, Mississippi. And it turned out, when I went back to investigate those years as an adult, I learned that there had been a huge controversy around the speech at the time, that the principal of my school had issued an order that I could not give that speech to the Lions Club. That teacher who defended me physically that day had come to my defense with the principal, and finally it had taken the superintendent of schools that had to make the decision of whether I would be allowed to give that speech. All of these were things that I didn't know anything about as a child, but I later learned them. But I also learned when I went back and I pieced together that whole story, I learned that the man who verbally assaulted me that day was also the man who shot that 16-year-old boy back in 1968. Same man. And so I wrote a long essay about all of that. Yeah, exactly. That's the peril of living in the neighborhood of a writer. We write, but so I wrote a long essay about all that appeared in Harper's Magazine 21 years ago, and after that was published, the man who had been the mayor of the town all through my childhood wrote a letter to the editor in which he said that that no one in my hometown could remember any of those events having ever occurred, not a one of them. The whole thing. And I think he was actually telling the truth in his own mind. You know, he was actually telling the truth that, and what that's about, and I'm going to wrap up here, what that's about is that whether we like it or not, there is a part of the American condition that trains us to forget certain things. And there are things that we work hard to forget, whether we know it or not. And so we end up trying to blank out these elements of our history that don't fit with the triumphal story. And my message about this, and my message about, you know, the question of what does our racial history matter in the era that we live in today, is that of course it matters, and these are things that have to be remembered, not to inflict pain on ourselves, not to engender animosity among people, maybe not even in a sense of remedying specific injuries to specific people. That's really not the argument that I make. But the argument I make is that we have to fight the compulsion to forget these parts of the story, because number one, the triumphal parts of our story are that much more triumphal when we're honest about the mistakes we made, too. When we're honest about the terrible sidetracks that also occurred in American history and how we got back on the right track. I mean, that's a far more triumphal story than this myth about that we were perfect from day one and nothing bad ever happened and that God is responsible for all of that. That's a myth. And it's much more dramatic, much more powerful if we accept the bad things that occurred and that we overcame and that we still have to overcome in some respects. But so we should combat that impulse to forget these things. We should also combat the impulse to beat each other up with the bad parts of our history. But in this time of great progress, when so much has been achieved, and when we do have an African-American president, whether we like him or not, whether, you know, the politics of it don't matter, but we're in this period where so much good has been achieved, it's nonetheless still absolutely critical that we remember and we continue to investigate the things that happened in the past so that we can understand better what we've accomplished and so we can identify the reasons for the things that still need to change. Because these events, what I write about in my book, the things that were happening in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, and I think some of you here were alive in those days, obviously. Well, there are thousands of African Americans who are alive today who were born on a farm in South Alabama in a state of de facto slavery or some other place in the South. And so these are not ancient events. These are the explanations for much of the issue, many of the issues that are most important in American society today, if we're sincere about that we want our country to continue moving toward becoming a place where truly everybody, if they work hard and try hard and take up the opportunities that are before them, will in fact be able to be confident of success in life in America. I think we all, no matter what our politics are, we all basically agree that that's the vision of the country that that we all agree on. And if we're sincere about that, then we also have to be sincere and honest about why it is that there's still a great legacy from these events of the past. So I'll stop there. And I think I've consumed all of your time. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure. I'm going to call on people. Okay, sure.
Very much. I had never heard of this forced labor. I've lived in Virginia for 50 years now, never an inkling of it. Once someone was put into this situation, was that a situation for life? Were they ever released from that?
That's a very good question. And that's one of the primary differences between the kind of enslavement that I'm talking about and the kind you know more about from before the Civil War. One of the main differences was that it wasn't necessarily slavery for a lifetime, because there were these on paper at least, it was supposed to be that you've been fined this $150 and some company acquires you and they agree to pay the sheriff or to pay the state $10 a month until that amount has been paid off. And so you're going to spend, it's supposed to be that for this $5 fine, you're going to end up working for a year or a year and a half for this in this coal mine somewhere. That's how it was supposed to work. And there were a lot of people who, in fact, did work out their time and then they were released. But there were also huge numbers of cases where that didn't happen. And when you go through the records, it's also clear there were tremendous numbers of people who are they're working in some labor camp somewhere, and there were hundreds of these labor camps. They were all over the place. Like in Georgia in 1900, there were probably 40 or 50 of these labor camps just in Georgia. And in Alabama, thousands of people in these coal mines at the time. And when you go back through the records of these ostensible arrests, like in one year in Alabama that I looked at, there was a table of all the state prisoners who were in these various work camps and what sentences they had been charged on. And the largest category, among all these offenses, you know, there's murder and vagrancy and all these misdemeanors and these things. But then the biggest category was no charge cited. So this, you know, the records, you know, there's nobody even has a claim of what the supposed crime was. But people did get out many times. But the mortality rates were spectacular because these individuals were malnourished. They got no medical care, and because they were so inexpensive to acquire, you could get a black man, you know, a great worker for $10 a month. Unlike in antebellum slavery, where that same person might have cost an antebellum white landowner $1,000 to acquire. You know, that's a tremendous investment. There was more money invested in the ownership of slaves than anything else before the Civil War. But now these workers cost almost nothing. So you can work them to the very edge of death. You know, you can work them to the absolute limits of human capacity. And so they were treated much more brutally than slaves had been in the antebellum period. And so the mortality rates were incredibly high, 30-40% oftentimes in many of these places, and sometimes higher than that. And so a very short sentence was often a death sentence. But legally and technically and in many cases, it was not supposed to be a life sentence. And there were people who got out, and they went back to their communities, as you can imagine, profoundly, profoundly affected by that, and then as a harbinger of this sort of terror, you know, a messenger of how terrible it is to have this happen to you, so find a way not to have this ever happen. Go along with whatever you have to go along with to avoid this.
Hi, I'm 5 years older than you and lived in Tougaloo, Mississippi, so I lived a lot of the same stories that you're telling, and I was back here just like, yes, yes. And I'm looking forward to your second book.
It'll be a few years.
All right, well, I'll wait. I'm not that old. I can wait. But I was interested, you know, there are those who point to the war on drugs and the imprisonment of so many African Americans as kind of another wave of this same sort of principle, and I wondered if you had any comment on that.
Yeah, it's not the same thing, but they're related. And I will just say as a general observation that the mass incarceration situation that we have today, where, you know, we incarcerate more people than pretty much any country in the world, you know, more than China, it's not a simple issue, and there are no simple solutions to the issue, but that is a cancer on our time. And that is the issue that 50 years from now, some group of people sitting in this room or another one hearing a talk like this, they'll be hearing from somebody who is talking about this period of time in American history when we were incarcerating this gigantic percentage of the population, and continuing to do that even after all kinds of evidence has accumulated, as it has, that there are large numbers of people convicted of crimes that they did not commit. And that's an empirical fact now. And Virginia is one of the places where that can be more powerfully demonstrated than a lot of others because of some specific records that have surfaced here. But you've got so many people in prison today that we know by statistical probability did not commit the rape or the murder or the armed robbery that they were convicted of. And DNA evidence has revealed to us that. And so we have this system that is full of defects, but that continues to incarcerate this giant population of people. And no matter how we got to this place or how hard it is to get out of it, that is the thing that future generations are going to look back and say, how could they have let that happen? How could they have just sat there and stared in the face this obvious, massive injustice? And that is the indictment that will be the primary indictment, I suspect, of my grandchildren against me and my time.
Doug, two of the movies that I've enjoyed over the years, well, one is Cool Hand Luke, and the other is Oh Brother,
Where Art Thou?
These involve white guys, but it seemed like they were in prison or incarcerated with a group of black guys on a chain gang. Was this a common thing?
That's a great question. Others here will remember Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier in the Defiant Ones. Is that right? Yeah. That's a very interesting question. You know, the way that I mark a good day when I go out to talk about any of this is if someone asks me a question that hasn't been asked before, and you get the prize. This is now a good day. Thank you. No, that's a great thing. And in fact, I talk a little bit about it in the book, very briefly, there is this depiction of convict labor in film. Now, it all goes back to the very end of the period of time that I'm talking about. You know, those are all films that are set in basically the 1940s. And the system that I'm talking about is actually finally shutting down and evolving. And of course, what it evolves into is the chain gang system. And the chain gang system, which we all are more familiar with, and we generally, you know, particularly kids today, if they hear about the chain gangs, that's depicted to them as the most terrible thing that, you know, could possibly have been done, how terrible chain gangs were. Well, chain gangs were the reform that were to the thing that I wrote about. And there was a movement to finally to say, well, actually, why don't we have these guys out on the roads because the roads are so bad, too. So let's finally have some decent roads and better for them to be under the control of the state and not being worked to death in these coal mines. And so the chain gangs grow, or in a certain way, a very specific reform to all this. So the movies that we see, though, tend to depict that period of time, just as the chain gangs are coming into place. But interestingly, the representation of them, the stars of those films, are always white guys. And Cool Hand Luke is in a camp that has, you know, there are some black characters, some black guys in the background. But basically, it gives you the impression that it's probably a majority white place with some black guys there, maybe reflecting the actual population of you know, some place at the time. But the reality was, that's completely a false depiction. That the places like those would have been overwhelmingly black, with a very small number of white guys in them. And it is true that there were some whites who were sucked into this very same system. They were treated better, and in fact, but they were in the system, and some of them were abused terribly. In fact, those rare moments when there was some outrage about all of this usually would come after a white person had been sucked into the system and then really brutally killed, and so tortured to death. Or there was one case in Florida in the 1920s where a young white man from Wisconsin, from a fairly wealthy farm family, was out riding the rails around the country to sort of see the world, 19 years old, and he ends up being arrested because he's riding on a train, and one of the most common things was to stop a train. In fact, lots of train conductors were sort of in the business of telegraphing ahead to a sheriff that I got, you know, 25 riders, you know, in the empty cars. And so then he would stop the train across the county line, and the sheriff would grab all these guys and sell them into a timber camp the next day. And so this kid, white kid, gets caught up in one of those things and is taken to this heinous place in North Florida, and then gets sick and won't work, and then is literally whipped to death. He's lashed to death by this brutal overseer. And that eventually leads, because his parents had some means, they hire a lawyer, because the family was told that he had died of malaria. Even though they had sent money down to get him out, but by the time the money got there, he was already dead. So they then hire a lawyer. There was this investigation in the 1920s, and that leads to some outrage because it happened to a white person. So those sorts of things would happen every now and then. But the reality is that those film depictions of even the last stages of this are grossly inaccurate. This overwhelmingly occurred to black people and just to a very small number of whites.
So you're pointing out that in the future we're going to look back and say that, oh my gosh, you know, what have we continued on? To bring it right down into our community, there's the Human Rights Commission that has been brought in front of our city council to talk about how there are people in our community that are still being violated. Our criminal system right here in our community is still packed full of African Americans. So I'm not sure I'm asking you, I'm asking everybody in the room, or, you know, this is very much in our home, in the present.
Yeah, well, I think that's, you know, not just your home, but in, you know, thousands of other people's homes, too. I think that's absolutely right. And I don't know the answer. And I know and understand a lot more about how we got here than, you know, how we get out of here. But I will say that number one, we will never get out of here until we're able to just say it the way I said it a minute ago, that it's not a debate that this is a terrible thing. And there is a debate about why it has come to pass, but there's not a debate about, there's nothing to debate over that a society that imprisons as many people as we imprison today has got something going really wrong. And particularly a society that continues to incarcerate this many people, even as crime rates continue to fall and fall and fall. And the back in the 80s and the 90s, when crime rates were zooming, and everybody, that's another part of this we've got to be honest about, everybody in America, black, white, and otherwise, was actually in favor of dramatically more harsh treatment of criminals. And three strikes and you're out was popular with every kind of folk, not every single person. But if you look at the polling and such back then, across the board, people were supportive of these things, coming from all constituencies. And so we got into this pattern that did, in many respects, begin with the Rockefeller drug laws, and we end up with these incredibly harsh penalties, often for pretty small crimes. You know, that is reflective of what I was talking about 100 years ago too, but where you have a young black man who ends up in jail for a long time because of a very minor drug possession or something like that, and the white kid at UVA who possesses the same amount of stuff somehow doesn't end up in any kind of trouble at all for it, in part because he's got a different version of the same stuff. The fact that we have a system that does that now on the scale that it does, when crime is actually falling, is a really profound paradox and contradiction. And the and now part of the complication is also that, you know, that young man who's in prison for that drug possession, in most cases, did in fact possess the drug, did break the law, unlike my guys from 100 years ago, who oftentimes had in fact done absolutely nothing. They're just snatched. And so the law may be unjust, the penalty for it may be unjust, but the law was broken because this law was created. And so untangling that is very, very complicated. But that is something that people of goodwill, whether they're conservative or liberal or otherwise, because it's the most conservative idea of all, the most basic cornerstone of conservative thinking, is to say that the power of the government cannot be misused in a way that you end up in taking the freedom away from our own citizens. You know, that's the bedrock of conservative thinking. And so that, so this is not just a liberals trying to take it easy on criminals thing. This is something that all Americans who are committed to the most fundamental constitutional concepts would say something is terribly, terribly amiss. And it's something we ought to be talking about in a much more aggressive way than even the more aggressive way we've been in the last few years.
Do you have any idea whether the post-Civil War history that you've told us about is being taught anywhere in the public schools these days?
Yes, actually, I am aware of that. I will tell you that, you know, it's also in the face of how little history is being taught at all to American children today. This is certainly not a story that has been a part of the standard curriculum, and it's really still not. But one of the great things about doing the PBS documentary was that because it's PBS, you have to have a tremendous amount of educational material and components that go with that. And so there's now a curriculum for how to teach this to middle schoolers and high schoolers, if for teachers who want to, and a lot of people access those materials. And if you are teachers or know teachers, go to pbs.org and find the Slavery by Another Name page there, and it'll guide you to all this. We also, with the production, we hired a group of education consultants who developed that curriculum, and then we did teacher training seminars in five or six cities around the country where we had middle school teachers come in and we talked about all this. And it's really not about just this story, but it's just the topic of how to teach difficult things. You know, how do you teach this sort of stuff in a way that that is effective, and so there's that. And then I hear from teachers all the time, and I talk at I go to a lot of universities and the occasional high school. I was just out at the big inner city high school in Omaha, Nebraska, a week or so ago, and so there's interest in it among a certain type of ambitious teachers. Yeah,
I'm here primarily because I read about you being here. And I guess I came to really think, wonder, what would you say that we can do tomorrow for better race relations? Now, it may interest you that here in Charlottesville, Virginia, we might to be the first city to desegregate the school by court order after May the 17th, 1954. And not wanting kudos myself, but I was with my wife, a public school teacher, were among the first plaintiffs for desegregating our schools.
Wow.
But more important, it's so depressing now to know that you can still, with senior citizens, and all of us can perhaps relate to it, that you go from one doctor's office to another, doctors getting these federal funds from Medicare and Medicaid, and so often you, with all the magazines in the waiting room, there is not a single one with black writers or black covers.
Mm-hmm.
That's extremely depressing. You likewise can go in these in the hospitals and see open desegregation or discrimination in employment. And so it appears to me that with history and with our good writers, much like you, that after we give the history, then the conclusion could be what we can do tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the question I'd like to pose to you now.
Yeah, well, that's a good question and a hard question. And I also would congratulate you first on the life that you've led. And I would also say that, and I really sincerely believe this, that it's important for us to, particularly for people who are really interested in these questions, who are naturally motivated around them, there is a tendency among us to sometimes get depressed about the things that persist and the disparities that continue and some of the very same things that you're talking about. And sometimes you get in conversations where I've been in many of them where people that I knew as a child who your counterparts, really, the man who was the superintendent of the black schools in my town up to the point of desegregation was the first African-American I remember ever sitting at a table with because my parents were moderate whites who were trying to help navigate the times as best they could. And so Mr. and Mrs. Trim came to our house for dinner one night. I'm pretty sure that was the first time a black family had ever been to our home. And I came to know and admire the Trims profoundly, and they both have died in the last few years. But I remember one of my last conversations with him. He was saying to me, we in the end we didn't accomplish anything. You know, things are just as bad as they were before. He was depressed that at the state of things. And I said to him at the time, I said, Mr. Trim, I know that a lot of things are not the way that you had dreamed they would be, but it's not true that things haven't changed. That nothing was accomplished. Just look around. And of course that's the case. And that's the case here in Charlottesville too. That tremendous things have been accomplished, and I know you're not suggesting that they haven't. But it is important to remember that. It's also important to remember, because this gets to your question, it's also important for everybody to be aware of and to remember that, in terms of the things I write about in terms of this system of enslavement begin to break down in the 1940s. But it's really not until the 1970s, it's not until 1970 itself, really, that you can make any kind of argument that African Americans on a large scale have honest, reasonable access to the levers of achievement economically and educationally in America, the same access that most white people have, or even some version of that. Real opportunity isn't awarded to African Americans until the 1970s. And what has happened since then, in that period of time? Well, African Americans, since 1970, if you're honest about the baseline, just the baseline of poverty and educational attainment in 1969 or thereabouts, since 1970, African Americans have accomplished more economically and educationally than any ethnically identifiable group of people in human history. I mean, that's just a fact. That's just a mathematical fact. And that's even acknowledging the tremendous disparities that persist, and all the problems that remain. And my point of that, and it gets to what to do tomorrow. Now, I can't actually give you a very good exactly tomorrow what to do thing, in part because I'm new to this community, and all of you probably have a better idea of what would be close to the top of that tomorrow list than I would. And every community and every person has to decide that for themselves. You know, that, you know, what needs to happen here is something that you know, and I really don't. But in trying to decide what that is, it's critical to remember that this is not about that something needs to be done for black people now because something bad happened to them in the past. That's what a lot of white people think. A lot of white people think that that's what that's what this argument is about. Oh, they had this bad stuff happen to them a long time ago, and it's been over for a long time, but they still want something for it. And I thought we took care of that. You know, that's what a lot of white people think. Even good-hearted white people think some version of that. But in my mind, that's not what this is about. What it's about is that in that 40-year period of time, when African Americans were achieving so spectacularly, what else was happening in America in the same period of time? Spectacular growth for everybody. You know, the country took off in that same period of time. And the fact that all of you are able to, you know, have whatever your retirement situation is, or whatever is what it's going to be, but this incredibly robust period of time in American history that all of us have benefited so much from is inextricably related to the fact that we finally liberated this huge population of our citizens who had been prohibited from real achievement and success in many respects until that point in time. When you finally set these folks free, these ambitious, smart, motivated people who really want just to have the same opportunities as everybody else, what happens? Well, they accomplish all kinds of amazing things. You know, some of those stories are embedded in the film that we made about all this. And when that happens, it lifts the whole economy. The whole country is profoundly affected positively by all of that. And so this isn't about making up for the bad things that were done. I mean, that's kind of what it's about. But there's a stronger motivation of that the country that your children and grandchildren are going to thrive in the most is one that is honestly offering real opportunity and real access to all the things that people need and deserve to be able to pursue their dreams. The country that offers that to everybody without any question and has some awareness of the things that occurred in the past is the country that your children and grandchildren, whatever they look like, are going to have the most success in, are going to live the best lives in. And that's the reason to really be looking at what do we do tomorrow. The specifics of what that are, I'm not sure, except for one thing, and that is the advice that I give to everybody, and that is that I believe in speaking plainly. And that's something that we don't do very often. But I believe in white people in particular don't want to speak plainly. But speak plainly about these things. Don't shy away from these conversations. Whatever the issues are in Charlottesville, no one is going to spontaneously combust if we have a conversation about them. Nobody's head will explode if we start talking about some of this stuff. So just talk about it. Even the things that you're terrified of talking about, just do it. Just talk about it. And in that candid conversation, there's a much higher probability that it will become more clear, not just what needs to be done first tomorrow, but that it is something that is bearable and doable and that there's a way to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, just quick comment. I had an African-American roommate in 1960 in Boston, which wouldn't have been that unusual, I guess. But my wife and my introduction to the Deep South was at Stone Mountain Resort in 1965. Oh, wow. And driving up through the chain gangs, it seemed like there were 100 people, all African-American, working on the roads going there. Yeah. The question is, when did the Great Migration out start? I think it was the 40s when the war plants started up. And were there any opportunities to get out from this new slavery from the Deep South go north to the factories and things?
That's a good question, and I'm sure some of you may have read Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Another Sun, which is a great treatment of the Great Migration. I also would mention a book that's out there by a woman named Michelle Alexander called The New Jim Crow that is very specific to mass incarceration and the prison system. I don't agree with everything in that book or Isabel's book for that matter, but we talk about each other's books a lot. Plainly, exactly, we do, exactly, and sometimes with verbosity, as you have experienced. It's interesting though to factor the Great Migration into this, because one of the things that Isabel Wilkerson writes about in her book, and what she did was she interviewed more than 2,000 people who had been part of the Great Migration of African Americans from the South to the North, which really begins a little bit after World War One. It sort of begins in the 20s, and then in a significant way in the 20s, and then really accelerates in the 30s, and then your World War II just takes off like crazy. And by the end of that, economic opportunity in the North is of course a big element of it. But what was interesting about one of the observations that Isabel Wilkerson made was that the standard telling of the story of the Great Migration was that this huge population of African Americans moving north was precipitated primarily by the boll weevil. And the first great boll weevil campaign, where the boll weevil infests the whole South in about 1915, that's when the first real catastrophe of the boll weevil sweeps across the South. And small farmers were wrecked everywhere, and sharecrop farms were wiped out. And so the sort of explanation was that these African Americans thrown into an even deeper level of poverty because of the boll weevil catastrophe that unlooses them, and lots of places stop growing cotton. You know, cotton disappears from Virginia some decades later, but it's because of the boll weevil that people stop growing cotton in Virginia eventually. And it's the destruction of the boll weevil now that has brought cotton back to Virginia and climates this far north. But when Isabel Wilkerson goes and interviews 2,000 people who are part of the Great Migration, not one of them ever says a word about the boll weevil. Not a one of them. Nobody ever says, oh yeah, our family left after the boll weevil came through, you know, even though that's the standard history. And what they say is, we had to get out because my daddy or my granddaddy realized that there was no hope that anything would ever change. They had been trying and believing that things were going to change and that there was going to be some kind of opportunity someday, and that the laws that had been put in place that were supposedly on our side were going to finally be enforced. And finally, my father, my grandfather, my uncle, or somebody said, we are never going to have anything better than what we've got, and it's actually getting worse. And that's what motivated the tremendous number of people to begin leaving. And then once there was demonstrable opportunity in some of these other places, then that accelerated things. Even though, and this is also part of the story, is that, you know, huge numbers of people got to Chicago and found it, you know, not that much, not all that much better in some respects. But ultimately, it was a better world and a better life. But so these things are very, very closely related to one another. Just how terrible it was, how much more terrible it was than we have generally accepted, is fundamental to understanding that giant migration of African Americans. Thank you all so much. It's really been a pleasure.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.